Please be seated. So, as is suitable in Lent, we've just heard sort of a package of readings that point us towards something we know, if we're in any way connected with Western culture at least, as the fall. Fall from grace, the fall of man, the fall. And even if you're not a terribly theologically inclined person, you know about this. And even if you say you don't care about it, you're probably influenced by it in some way. It's rather foundational to our culture. And it's also presumed to be foundational to the entire corpus of Scripture, coming as it does close to the beginning. It's considered to be a decisive text as the origin and explanation for evil. In the event of original sin, with death as a consequence. Augustine worked on this quite a bit. He developed a fairly literal anthropology from this, mainly working from Paul's letter to the Romans, which we also heard today. And Paul very brilliantly argues, using this text, this sort of one-to-many argument, Adam's sin, salvation in Christ. It's a wonderfully constructed argument. And it is, trust me, foundational to systematic theology. Great thinkers from Augustine through to Martin Luther, Calvin, all those people just took this as, you know, gospel and worked their thoughts up from there. Very complex logical structures. So it's influential, even when it's not taken literally, and even if you're not theological, and terribly influential if you are. The problem is, and there's a couple of problems, this is not, the Old Testament text here is not a treatise or any kind of sustained argument, and Paul is not making that kind of treatise or sustained argument from it. Paul, like he usually is doing, is making an occasional argument, which is not to say he does it once in a while, but he does it for an occasion, for a particular problem in a particular community he's about to visit. And in this case, it's the tension between Gentiles and Jews, which it so often is in the New Testament. And essentially, he's working up an argument roughly somewhere in chapters 9 and 11 to say, more or less, to the Gentiles, you know, chill out. Don't be so uppity with your recently returned from exiled Jewish brothers and sisters in the faith. Right? This is a big social problem he's about to contend with, and it's an unpopular position that he's taking. And there is one school of thought which suggests that all of chapters 1 through 8 are essentially a kind of a softening lead-up argument to this. The other position, of course, is that it's all quite literal and it's all quite systematic, and Paul's actually making a statement connected to this systematic understanding of Genesis, blah, 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 and on you go, and you have pretty much normative theology, right? The theology of punishment, the theology of evasion of punishment, the theology of us having been once pristine, apparently immortal, and through some tragic error of some kind, we fell from that. So the other problem is the notion of fall itself is a Greek notion imported into Christian thought, and it's based on their notion that our ideal state or primeval state is spiritual, it's ethereal, non-bodily, and we fell into bodies. Yuck! You know? And the whole goal is to get out of them again. So you can see how Christian thinking has been influenced by this little non-bodily dualism, right? Even though we don't literally affirm it, it's lurking and it's operative in the background. And so if you don't believe me, you could believe Walter Brueggemann, arguably the greatest living Old Testament scholar, one of the greatest ones who's ever lived. And he says, and I quote, "The reading from Genesis we heard today is an exceedingly marginal text. It's not actually, it doesn't follow in its creation the creation narratives. It's earlier than that. It comes from a very early mythic era, borrowing extensively from all sorts of ancient Near Eastern stories and narratives. And interestingly, there are almost no subsequent Old Testament reference to this tale. If it was so structurally foundational, would there not be other references to it? How evil came into the world. A very abstract notion, which itself, abstraction, is also alien to the Old Testament, for that matter. We really need to resort to analogy and metaphor to get anything out of this at all. The Bible does not reflect mechanistically on connections between sin and death as such, and certainly not in any sustained way. What we heard today, this famous story of the fall, is more a reflection on creation with its limits. I mean, it is limited, right? I mean, limited by death, if nothing else, but we are limited creatures, flawed. There's a flawed, seemingly flawed aspect to creation. You know, we can stumble and make mistakes. We work with its limits, but this was, God called it good. Creation with its limits, God called it good. So this is a reflection on how to work with that. The concerns in Eden are not so abstract. They are existential, if I can use that word. Not about origins, but about a faithful response to life. I mean, it's no coincidence that reading further on in Genesis, we read that, you know, as a sort of a consequence of the eating the forbidden fruit, women shall endure great pain and suffering in childbirth and labor, and men will earn their bread by the sweat of their brow. And aside from the sort of gendered notions there, which are also characteristic of the ancient Near East and sadly our own time, aside from that, do they not simply describe life as it is to a large, in large measure, right? We work for our bread and, you know, childbirth is no fun. It's worse than kidney stones, I'm told. So could this not just be kind of retroactive storytelling? Just saying, right? It lines up with life, but that's not because necessarily it's causative as a tale. So maybe it's not so much a reflection on death as a reflection on the challenge and anxiety of life itself. There's a notion floating around now, largely from a fellow named David Bentley Hart, of what I'm calling the argument from coherence. He's not calling it that, but I think you could call it that. He argues that, you know, one of the main problems with some theologies is that they present a concept of God which is itself incoherent. And I think we might be working on that here. An example he provides is the God who created everything ex nihilo, out of nothing, out of sheer gratuitous love, that the main event for that God's creation would be punishment. He considers that to be an incoherent notion of God. Not so much because it's monstrous, which it surely is, but because it falls short of the mark of what Anselm described as that than which nothing greater can be thought. That's what you should be aiming for when you think of God. So what we have here with sort of punishing, endgame sort of God is really just a God among other gods, a competing rival, maybe the strongest and greatest of them all, but just not God, because how could God have rivals? How could God be usurped if whatever is attempting to rival and usurp God is in fact a creature, because there is nothing else outside of God, other than creatures? God made everything, including other gods if they exist. So the problem with this notion, this bifurcation of creation into heaven and hell at the end of time, is that it's an end game that does not actually coherently paint God for us. Moving on, if we're to apply that logic to this story from Genesis, it would suggest that creation was a mistake. I mean, you know, it's kind of what it says, right? Or maybe that God was usurped, or that God is somehow necessarily punishing and juridical. And this notion actually has some logic to it because, you know, if you think about God's purity and the impossibility of marrying God with sin and evil, like you can't mix those things. So for God to be God, God has to utterly reject sin and evil. So you end up with this notion of eternal separation, right? Because you can't have that stuff mingling with God. Okay, that's a reasonable idea, but you end up with a very incoherent notion if you follow it through to its logical conclusion, which is what systematic theology has been doing for about 1500 years. So we have a God who must punish, a God who must elect and condemn, a God who must reject us in order to be God. Incoherent. Sorry, incoherent. What we actually have, I think, is universal accountability to God's justice. And this is a difficult concept, which is why we prefer the other one, because it makes sense to us. It's like a good Charles Bronson movie with a revenge twist at the end. You know, we can kind of get that. Bad's punished, so I'll try to be good, and it'll work out okay. That makes sense. There's an end game. But really what it is, universal accountability. God's justice, and here's one of the mysteries of God. God's justice is God's mercy, which they aren't for us, right? Mercy and justice for us are like a toggle switch. We can sort of do one or the other. God is both on all the time, full blast. It's incomprehensible, frankly, but that's what we got to deal with. That is getting towards coherence, as mysterious as it is. So, getting back to Anselm here, what's the greatest thing we can imagine? Perhaps it's a God of love, but a God of love because God risks loving. Love is inherently risky. You can't have it without risk. It's like saying, God, make me a square circle. Create a married bachelor. Oh, you can't? Oh, that must be a weakness. No, that's just a silly question. It's a silly challenge. It's nonsense. It's like, God, make a nothing something. It's just daft. It's not even a question. God risked love in the sense that, can you even imagine making a creature who you hope, who you desire to love you in return, without giving that creature the option of making that choice? Spinoza said, if I wanted a race of adoring kind of automatons, I would have just made dogs. And I like dogs, don't get me wrong. But he made humans. It's inherent in the proposition that to love means you could choose not to love. That's us, right? That's us in a nutshell. Humans, the glory and chief problem of creation, also inherent in the design. Power and freedom. It even says, you'll be like God, you'll acquire the knowledge of good and evil. That's the most important thing. That's kind of what it's saying, right? We evolved, I suppose, if you take evolution as how it happened, into creatures with moral capacity. And at that point, we could sort of look back and fashion a story like this to kind of account for this weird tension that we, and it seems only we, have to contend with in our lives. Power and freedom comes with responsibility. So perhaps this story is about human vocation. Living in God's world with creation and with God's other creatures on God's terms, with prerogatives, freedoms, permissions, and limits. We heard that in the story. Permissions and limits, those are real things. Opportunities and consequences. Sounds like life, doesn't it? Now, a vision of sinful humanity in need of grace is not out of place. It's useful. It's necessary. But we need to remember that moral awareness and mortal awareness are unique to our condition, and they come together, right? I mean, animals don't really have moral awareness. They eat, they kill, they do what they do, but it's not a moral issue. They may not want to die, they may shriek when they're killed, but they don't sit around worrying about their inevitable death while they're chewing their cud. They don't have that capacity. Only we can do that. It's a curious thing. It's a call to live in the tension and the risk of this moral prerogative. And we heard today about Jesus in the desert. Temptation. Temptation is always to power. Bread for stones. To replace creation as it is, with all its limits, to replace it with something else, something of our own imagining or making. Power. And death is part of creation. As Paul says elsewhere, our outer nature is wasting away. But this is not a hopeless analysis of the human predicament or the human condition. Because elsewhere it also says our inner nature is being renewed every day. The gardener, the creator in this wonderful story. The gardener is always at work on our behalf, giving us fig leaves or whatever. You know, whatever we need to get by in the flawed way that we choose to proceed. There is always hope. We are nothing if not a people who crave and find hope. So like Adam and Eve, our concern is not the danger of the fall, or the origin of evil, or sin and death. It's a summons from God who calls us to be God's creatures, to live in the world and with other creatures on God's terms.